good evening. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views and the views of our guest. And our guest this evening is Peter Hammond from the Frontline Ministries, which is based in Cape Town, South Africa. And Peter travels all over Africa, indeed all over the world, preaching the Word of God and bringing a message of hope to people in many terrible, terrible places. Because, you see, Africa is a very violent continent at the present time, and yet as we talk to Peter, we find that the word of the Lord is spreading there. It's making tremendous inroads and making a tremendous difference. Peter Hammond, thank you so very much for being with us.
Thank you so much, Dr. Stan. Always a pleasure to be on Radio Liberty.
Well, it's always a pleasure to have you here. Now, tell us a little bit about, for our listeners who do not know you, why don't you tell them a little bit about Frontline Ministries?
Well, yes, Frontline Fellowship's been going now for 23 years. I've been a Christian now for 28 years and involved in missions for 26 of those years. The Lord led me to start Frontline Fellowship after my time in the South African Army. I'd been converted to Christ just shortly before going into the South African Defense Force. That was back during our time of fighting against the Cubans and Russians in Angola and defending Southwest Africa against the communist assault. It was right in the last days of the Cold War, and it was very hot down there in Africa, especially in Angola. And I had a prayer group and a Bible study group which met every night for prayer and for Bible study, and some nights we met all night for prayer. We prayed through Operation World. We were praying for different countries. And during these intensive times of Bible study and prayer, the Lord led our military fellowship to pray for our enemies. And God put a burden on our heart to reach those people who were caught up in the wars across the border, communist Angola, communist Mozambique, to reach them with the gospel and to help the persecuted churches who were suffering under communist oppression in those really oppressed countries. So as I left the South African Defense Force, I put together a mission organization, and there were just two of us and two motorbikes with the Jesus film and 1,000 Bibles in Portuguese initially. But we went behind the lines and took the gospel to our enemies and help persecuted churches, and that's how God led our mission. For the last 23 years, we've been helping people in restricted access areas, persecuted countries, mostly communist countries, but more recently Muslim nations too, where the church is persecuted. And that's been our goal, assisting persecuted churches, evangelizing in war zones, working for reformation, praying for revival throughout Africa.
Well, certainly Mozambique has changed tremendously. Originally, of course, it was a Marxist state, and now really it's really offering people all sorts of opportunities, isn't it?
Well, yes, this is quite extraordinary. In fact, this year is the 30th anniversary of the revolution in Mozambique. Back in June 1975, Mozambique became a communist state. It was a satellite state of the Soviet Union, really, because Russian troops by the thousands, Cuban troops by the thousands, East Germans ran the secret police. It was a real Marxist revolutionary state, sponsoring terrorists attacking neighboring South Africa and persecuting the church, burning churches. And yes, we worked in Mozambique. That was my first mission field. For the first 10 years of my mission, I specialized in helping to persecute church in Mozambique. But today there is religious freedom there, and many of the churches that were destroyed have now been handed back and are reopened and once again being used for the worship of Christ.
In fact, I understand that really some of the Boer farmers from South Africa have actually been encouraged to go by the Mozambique government, encouraged to go there to set up farms to begin to produce food. But we'll talk about that in just a moment when we get back from our break right here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Peter Hammond, and we're talking about what's going on in Mozambique, and we're talking about 30 years since the communist revolution there in 1975, and yet Mozambique is an entirely different country than it was 25 years or so ago when Peter first started going there. And really, of course, my understanding is that they've actually been really very hospitable to some of the Boer farmers. Is that true?
That is very true. There's many South African farmers who don't seem too welcome in their own family who've gone to Mozambique, and in fact, even Zimbabwean farmers have been encouraged to come over there. So it seems that Mozambique has had enough of Marxism. They had Marxist-Leninism shoved down their throat, 300,000 people publicly executed, thrown to concentration camps, over 8,000 churches destroyed, a man-made famine where a million people died of starvation in a green tropical country that used to export food. So they've had enough of Marxism. And right now, Mozambique, despite once being a Soviet satellite state, a launching pad for the battle against South Africa, it today is wide open for the gospel. And they are encouraging free markets. They have a multi-party system. And this country's being rebuilt. It's quite extraordinary, and we're most encouraged to see that the seeds of the gospel planted in Mozambique over these difficult years are bearing some good fruit.
Well, now, of course, is Christianity beginning to fare pretty well in Mozambique? Is it spreading? Are the people accepting the hope of the gospel?
They are indeed. In fact, Mozambique under the Portuguese was a Roman Catholic country. And the Roman Catholics would have been a very high percentage of the total population. Today, one-third of the total population of Mozambique are Protestants. Now, that's extraordinary, because there was not even 4% of Mozambique was Protestant or evangelical back at independence. In 1975, evangelicals were 3.5% of the population. Today, over 6 million Mozambicans are members of an evangelical or independent Christian church, a Protestant church. So 6 million out of 20 million people, total population, that's about a 33% of the people are now evangelicals. That's just extraordinary church growth.
Well, it certainly is, and it's sort of exciting to realize that how we really can change a community, you can change a nation when people turn to the Lord. Because, of course, where the Spirit of the Lord is, there's freedom, and where the Spirit of the Lord isn't, why, you have nothing but chaos and crisis.
That is it. And I think many people who, when you hear just Time magazine and CNN's version of Africa, all you see is, murder and mayhem.
Hold that thought right there. We'll be right back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening is Peter Hammond, just talking about what's really the miraculous things that have happened in Mozambique, where, well, before the communist revolution, about 4% of the population was Protestant. Today, about 30% of the population is Protestant. The country is offering freedom. It's encouraging people from other countries to come there. It's encouraging investment. You have religious freedom. The churches are being rebuilt. And so it's really been an amazing transformation of a society that 30 years ago, 25 years ago, was in total chaos. And yet, where the Spirit of the Lord is, there's freedom. So is there anything else we should cover with Mozambique before we get into Rhodesia, South Africa, and some of the other countries of Africa?
Yes, we certainly must pray for more discipleship. Mozambique is still a pioneer mission field. Many more missionaries are needed. The greatest need is for leadership training, youth work, children's work, translation work. Most of the population are still literate. There's a lack of scriptures in some of the languages. There's still animism, lack of biblical understanding of many doctrines, but there's a hunger for the gospel. And the decades of Marxist indoctrination created a society that's morally bankrupt and where life is cheap and violent and short. But the people are completely disenchanted with Marxism. They have lost all faith in the government. They've lost all faith in the secular solutions and the United Nations. So they're wide open for the gospel, and the church is growing in this situation. So what I think we need to remember is behind the bad news of what Satan is doing in Africa is God's news of what God's doing in spite of man's wickedness. And the church is growing in some very unexpected, unfertile ground where you would have expected. expected nothing, and yet that's the news that's not being reported generally, what God is doing in spite of man's wickedness in Africa.
Well, let's get off into Rhodesia, because there, of course, we see that things seem to be going from bad to worse. We hear massive unemployment, destruction of the value of the currency, flight of the white people, in fact, even flight of massive number, literally millions of black Rhodesians, once, of course, from this workers' paradise, this communist satellite state that was brought to power with thanks to the efforts of the American State Department, the Carnegie Foundation, and certain other people within our government who were intent upon creating another Marxist state in Africa. Well, so could you tell, first of all, what's going on in Rhodesia, and then how this whole thing came about?
Well, you know, people are speaking about the Mugabe tsunami, like the tsunami destroyed so many homes of hundreds of thousands of people in Indonesia and Thailand at the end of last year. In the same way, Mugabe, the Marxist dictator of Zimbabwe, has destroyed the homes of 1.5 million people. I mean, imagine that, 1.5 million people in Zimbabwe have had their homes destroyed by the government of Zimbabwe. We're talking about the Marxist regime of Zimbabwe. Their police and army have burned down or bulldozed the homes of literally 1.5 million people just in the last 4 months. And by the way, that has included hundreds of churches. So we're talking about hundreds of churches flattened. And then some of the people whose homes have been destroyed, have been left absolutely destitute, have fled to churches, and many churches have housed and provide sanctuary for them, and they've been attacked by police and army and riot police, who have literally evicted these people, thrown them on the backs of trucks and taken to who knows where, not to be seen since. So here you've got the poorest of the poor people in Zimbabwe being targeted by the government and absolutely all their livelihood destroyed.
But of course, this is black destroying black, or black destroying the homes of black.
That's correct. I think one needs to see the sequence of what's actually happened. Some people may have heard of the destruction of the white farms in Zimbabwe, and they wonder, well, where does all this fit in? To put it into perspective, you would remember that Rhodesia was a pro-Western, pro-Christian government, an ally of the United States in the First and the Second World War, and the Korean War. Well, in the 1960s and 70s, Rhodesia fought a war of survival against Marxist terrorists. It was on the front line of the Cold War battles, and the Soviet Union and Red China supported terrorists, including Mugabe, who were trying to overthrow the pro-Western government.
Now, I think that for our listeners, they have to understand that Mugabe was a communist. He was trained in China, wasn't he? Wasn't he a Maoist to China?
He was, under Mao Zedong's China. And the Rhodesians won all their battles. In fact, the little courageous country, the small army, even being sanctioned worldwide, was winning all the battles and doing quite well. And along came Henry Kissinger. Henry Kissinger, U.S. Secretary of State at the time in the 70s, came and offered the peace plan, and he promised the Rhodesian people, and I remember it still as someone brought up in that country, crystal clear, like it was yesterday, Henry Kissinger coming on TV and saying to the Rhodesian people, looking straight into camera, if you will accept the U.S. peace plan, then the United States government guarantees the rule of law, private ownership property, and your farms if you will accept this. And you have nothing to fear. The full weight of the United States government will be there to protect your farms, to protect your homes, to ensure the rule of law. Just accept the peace plan and, you know, everything's going to be wonderful.
Of course, you really didn't understand that Henry Kissinger is a pathological liar. He's betrayed country after country throughout the world. And unfortunately, the Rhodesian people believed Henry Kissinger, believing he spoke for the American people.
That's correct. We really believed that we had our friends, our allies, the United States government, the leader of the free world, Christian people, we had their word, and we could take this to the bank. And so the Rhodesian people did accede ultimately to the U.S. peace plan, accepted one man, one vote, accepted majority rule, accepted the peace plan, which involved handing the country over to the British, who handed it over to Mugabe.
Well, I thought originally the people of Rhodesia actually elected Bishop Mezeweo, who was a very moderate black and probably would have been an excellent leader, but he wasn't acceptable to the United States State Department.
No, he was a Christian, not an atheist, and not a communist, and he is pro-Western, not pro-communist. So he got betrayed, and they handed over to this Maoist, Marxist, Robert Mugabe. Well, the first people Mugabe went after were the ethnic minority, the Matabele. And something like 50,000 Matabele were slaughtered in 1982, 1983 by North Korean-trained 5th Brigade. That's like the political force of Robert Mugabe's government. And not too many people seemed concerned that a bunch of Matabele tribesmen were being killed. After all, they were just the ethnic minority, something like the Tutsis being killed in Rwanda, but this was Zimbabwe. But then what happened is in 1997, Mugabe decided to prop up Kabila's Marxist dictatorship in the Congo. So he poured in his troops, and at the cost of millions of dollars a day, he's been keeping his army in the Congo to maintain this fellow Marxist dictator who's never been elected, Kabila, in power. He also had a military adventure in Mozambique for many years as well, burning churches there. But in 1997 also, the veterans of the war, these are the ex-guerrillas, revolutionaries, insurgents, they demanded a pension. Mugabe gave them all the money they wanted, but he did it by printing more money, thereby inflating the currency. This started to collapse the economy even more as a result of course, the socialist utopian ideas, which didn't work. But people saw their pensions disappearing, they saw their savings disappearing, they saw their salaries worth nothing. So the country went into hyperinflation of hundreds of percent by this kind of irresponsible foreign adventurism and socialism, and now inflating the currency. Well, at this point, with the people furious, even his own soldiers furious and threatening rioting, Mugabe in the year 2000 pulls out the race card. He blames everything on the whites, even though there were only about 30,000 of them, and he allows his people, in fact encourages people, to invade the white farms. So this is the next step in the self-destruction, the national suicide of Zimbabwe. He says, well look, we've got these 5,000 commercial farms controlled by the whites, take them. And his mobs flood the white farms, and this is what they're called, land reform. But you mustn't think land reform meaning a white farmer is replaced by a productive black farmer. Not so. The land reform is just a communist term for what was nothing other than the looting, invasion, burning, and destruction of productive farms. Bear in mind that these 5,000 commercial white farms, controlled by white farmers, were the largest employer in the country, providing employment for millions of people. It was the largest supplier of foreign currency, hard currency for the country, the largest exporter in the country, so it was the biggest part of the economy, and it fed the whole country of 10 million people plus exported. So what Mugabe allowed in trying to appease his angry, hungry people to invade and destroy these farms was he committed economic suicide. He destroyed the second most efficient and effective agricultural economy in the whole of Africa, second only to South Africa, and these farms were just pillaged, looted, burned, destroyed, absolutely horrific suffering required, and of course many farmers murdered, tortured, and this kind of racist lawlessness was horrific. Well, many of the people, of course, enjoyed looting and destroying, but then, within a short while, famine started the country. So the next step of Mugabe was the game reserves. You can take over the game reserves. So the wildlife sanctuary, some of the greatest game reserves on earth, were invaded by hundreds of thousands of Marxist thugs, war veterans, youth brigade, and they slaughtered the animals. Now, it went way beyond getting food. They set fire to tens of thousands of hectares of pristine forest. They machine-gunned herds of elephant. Nothing to do with food. They were just slaughtering for the sake of slaughtering because they were free to do it and they were now allowed to do it.
And of course, now you're talking about the elephants, you're talking about the rhinos, talking about the iron, the lions, all of the wonderful game reserves.
Endangered wildlife, some of the most wonderful wildlife sanctuaries on earth destroyed because of the greed and the short-sighted, mindless hatred of this man. And so the people were appeased for a while because they could eat some wildlife game and destroy. But then what happened was many of the people started to starve even further and they lost their jobs. The tourism disappeared. The people had jobs in the tourist economy lost. So what were they to do? And they started to oppose the government, and hence this recent Mugabe tsunami of destroying their homes. These people whose homes are being destroyed in Bulawayo and Harare are the people who started to vote against the government and speak against Mugabe's actions. So you see how things have come full circle. Even his supporters now are the ones who are opposing him, and he's retaliating.
And now, of course, how many million people have fled the country? How many million blacks?
I think it's something in the region of 5 million people out of a total population of 12 million. So you're talking about something...
Hold that thought right there, Peter. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Peter Hammond from Frontline Ministries, and he's saying that the population of Rhodesia had grown to about 12 million, and about 5 million of the 12 million blacks have fled the country. Now, certainly there were, you know, the 30,000 or so whites that were there. The vast majority of them have fled, if they could possibly, haven't they?
That's correct. I mean, 40% of the black people have fled, but the vast majority, like 90% of the whites, have left. From a high point of 300,000 at independence, the population of whites in Zimbabwe now is much less than 30,000, and we think most of those are out of the country right now. Anyway, there's probably not more than 16,000 whites in Zimbabwe at this moment.
And of course, actually, Nigeria has invited the white farmers from Zimbabwe to go there to, and offering them 5,000 acres of land if they'll just come and begin producing, putting farms in, because they know they can produce food. And the same thing has really happened in Mozambique, where they've invited the white farmers to come. And so these countries then will begin to become productive as far as food is concerned. And the people in Rhodesia today are starving to death because of the communist regime that was installed by the American State Department, with the promise that if things ever get out of hand, why, of course, we'll come and you know that you can trust America. Well, tell me, you know, what's happening as far as food is concerned? We understand that there's no medical supplies, there is very little food, that people really are hungry. Is there frank famine there? What's really going on?
Dr. Stan, it's heartrending. The country is in the grip of a man-made famine, and this is just so disgraceful to think. Here's a country that used to feed itself, export food, feed others, and now they are totally dependent on external aid. And our mission has to smuggle in tons of food to just feed some Christian workers and a few congregations that we are supporting. And it takes a lot of ingenuity to do that. Do you know that at the moment, South African churches have got tons of aid? We are talking about hundreds of tons of aid in pentechnicons, 18-wheeler semi-trucks that are lined up at Bike Bridge border, as you know, the border over the Limpopo River to go into Zimbabwe, and have been stuck there for weeks because the Zimbabwe government, the customs, will not let these church trucks bring in the free aid, which includes blankets and food and just basic things to sustain these people whose homes have been destroyed, whose livestock has been destroyed, whose food supply has been destroyed. And so the South African churches have been trying to, out of love for their neighbor, just taking some basic aid. Zimbabwe customs will not let them in without them paying millions of dollars, and I'm talking about American dollars, millions of dollars of customs duties to take in free relief aid to give to the people who the government of Zimbabwe has impoverished. You know, can you imagine anything so evil? And, of course, these churches can't afford to pay the vast, exorbitant status duties being required of them, and so these trucks are sitting at the border, and a lot of the foodstuff is wasting away. It's rotting in these trucks in the heat there, while the Zimbabwe government fiddles away, and the people are starving on the other side. People are dying for lack of medicine, such as we've been asked by relatives in England and other places to take in antibiotics and insulin for diabetics who can't get these medicines. Their lives are at stake, and they cannot go through the postal service. They cannot be achieved through the hospitals or the pharmacies, who are out of stock, and they won't be allowed through the border supply. So missions like us now have to smuggle in diabetic insulin to keep some people alive.
Hold that thought right there, Peter. We'll be right back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Peter is saying that people are starving there in Rhodesia. The South African churches have accumulated a great deal of food. It's sitting in large trucks, these trucks waiting to get across the border there, across the Limpopo River, and bring the food to the starving people. Many of them, this million people or more that have had their homes destroyed. They're homeless. They have no food. They have no clothing and no medication. And the people at the border, the Rhodesian forces there, will not allow these trucks in unless they pay, you know, millions, literally millions of dollars in tariff fees, or whatever they would call them, border fees. I really suppose they're bribes to let the food in to save the lives of the people there, that the people are trying to need diabetic medication. And so Peter, I won't ask him how he does this, but he has done this for many years. They actually smuggle things into the country to help the people. And are you trying to get the diabetic and other supplies in?
Yes, we are. This is a high priority, and I really do urge the Christian listeners to pray for our missionaries, pray for the evangelists, pray for the people who've got to do the smuggling, pray for the Christians suffering in Zimbabwe. This is persecution of the church. I think you need to understand it. This is not just some madman. This is Marxism in action. And there have been hundreds of churches bulldozed. They've been pastors arrested. They've been pastors murdered. Do you know, Dr. Stan, just a short while ago, there were 400 women who had a prayer meeting for peace. They were called Women for Peace. And the police attacked this Women for Peace prayer meeting, beat these women, and hospitalized 34 of the women who were beaten so severely they were literally hospitalized. And I don't know if reports on these kind of attacks on the church and prayer meetings in Zimbabwe are making the news in the United States, but it should.
Now, and of course, the thing is, we have very selective reporting in the United States. And for our listeners, if you don't listen to our program regularly, well, you probably don't understand that the media in America really is fairly tightly controlled. And we don't get a lot of the stories that we should be getting, especially about Zimbabwe. We don't hear about the people starving to death there. We don't hear about the mass murders there. Certainly when they were killing 50,000 Matabele in 82, this was hardly covered at all in the controlled media here. Why? Because our State Department had brought the communist control to power, and until people begin to understand that there's a great deal of disparity between what the American people believe in reality, and of course there really are people in our government who are not in the least bit anti-communist. Communism is a very convenient enemy to rally the people behind government leaders, but when you really look at it very carefully, you'll find that time and time again, our government has brought communist dictators to power. Well, you know, as far as the starvation is concerned, or the people trying to flee to get to other countries, into Zambia or into South Africa or into Mozambique or someplace where they can get food?
Yes, and you can imagine what a destabilizing effect that is when you've got something in a region of 5 million people out of a total population of 12 million fleeing the country, voting with their feet, going into neighboring countries. So the burden on neighboring Botswana and Malawi and Zambia, even Mozambique, imagine people fleeing to Mozambique, but that's how it's become now. People are fleeing now from Zimbabwe into every neighboring country, and of course there are about 2 million in South Africa alone. As far afield as Cape Town, we know them. Do you know another thing that's astounding, Dr. Stan? Most of the Zimbabweans who are getting food are now getting it from Zambia. And the funny thing is, the food that they're getting from Zambia is grown by the same Zimbabwe farmers that were kicked off the farms in Zimbabwe. This has actually happened. There are hundreds of farms now being run in Zambia that are being run by Zimbabwean farmers, white commercial farmers who were evicted from their farms for being the wrong race by the racist laws of Mugabe's government. And they were welcomed into Zambia. In fact, President Levi Mawanasa even personally went to receive some of these men, said, this is now your home, please settle in Zambia, here's the fields for you, and you will have whatever loans you need from the banks, no interest, to get your farm set up, we need you here, please consider this your home. And so the farmers that were being hated and evicted from Zimbabwe were welcomed into Zambia. And last year, for the first time since independence, Zambia had bumper crops, they had surplus, and so Zambia has been able to export hundreds of millions of tons of maize to Zimbabwe. And the funny thing is, while Zimbabwe's not going to pay a fortune for it, it's being grown by the same farmers they've just evicted from the country, which they could have had a whole lot cheaper.
Well, now, the thing is the food getting to the people, or is it going to other supporters of this Marxist dictator that we brought to power named Robert Mugabe? In other words, are the people getting any of the benefit of the food that's being sent in from Zambia or from the United States or other countries, or is it being very selectively distributed?
The short answer is, it's being selectively distributed only to ZANU-PF communist members. The government has openly said that they are not going to let the opponents of the government receive food. They've specifically said we'd be better off with
that. Hold that thought, please. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this afternoon, this evening, is Peter Hammond, and we're basically talking about what's going on in Zimbabwe. It used to be known as Rhodesia, but apparently the food that is being sent in from Zambia and from relief efforts from other countries is not going to the people. It's going to the supporters of the communist dictator that we installed, Robert Mugabe. And so, you know, in many ways, aren't we actually, through the efforts of the United States government and the humanitarian aid we're sending in, actually propping up this corrupt regime?
I believe that that's actually what's happened indirectly, because while the U.S. State Department has made a couple of noises that, you know, what's going on over there is unacceptable, the fact is the U.S. continues to supply the United Nations with 40% of its funding, and the United Nations is what is actually keeping the Zimbabwe government going. And that's absolutely outrageous, because Zimbabwe today, the ZANU-PF government, that's the communist government, they are monopolizing all food distribution. And they're loudly saying that if you support the opposition, you will starve. Didymus Mutusa, the deputy president, said, we will be better off with only 6 million people, with our own people who support the liberation struggle. We don't want these extra people. Literally, that's the deputy president openly broadcasting, you don't support us, you're going to starve. And they have made it illegal for missions like us to distribute any food aid to the people. All food aid must be given to the government, and the government will determine who they give it to. And so when the United Nations or World Food Program or anyone else wants to give food to Zimbabwe, it goes to the government and the people who caused the famine in the first place by closing down all the white-owned commercial farms and destroying the homes of the opposition people. They're the ones who reward their supporters with food, and they deliberately leave off those who are opponents of the government and let them starve to death. So you can see it's a man-made famine. This is just like what Stalin did in Russia with the dekulakization policy in the 1930s. Destroy the bourgeois farmers in the Ukraine and let 6 million people starve to death, because after all, as Stalin said, it's a small price to pay for 6 million to die to ensure that the rest of the country is controlled by the Communist Party.
Well, now, they still have their military contingent over in what used to be the Belgian Congo in Zaire?
Yes, they do. That's also got an interesting connection, because it is strongly believed that the reason why the Zimbabwe army is there is not only to prop up a fellow Marxist dictator, but because Mugabe owns a couple of diamond mines in the Congo, and so that actually this is to enrich themselves and look after their own interests. So
hold that thought right there, please. Well, this is Dr. Stan here, and our guest this evening is Peter Hammond from Frontline Ministries, and I had asked Peter about the contingent, the Rhodesian soldiers, Zimbabwean soldiers, who are in the Congo, they call it Zaire, but it's the old Belgian Congo, and Peter was saying that there's not only there to prop up the Marxist dictator Kabila, but also because it's said that Mugabe has several diamond mines there, and he wants, of course, stability so he can get his diamond mines and make all that money. So they are impoverishing the country. What does it cost? About $1 million a day to keep the military contingent there?
That's what it was a while ago. I believe it's more than that right now.
Where is Rhodesia getting $1 million a day?
Well, here's another couple of interesting connections here. There's the Red Chinese connection. Red China is a major supporter of the Zimbabwe government. In fact, they're at this moment building a new mega palace for His Excellency the President Robert Mugabe, and Red China is bringing in a lot of their cheap goods and their own people to sell it. So this is the other side of the whole coin. We know that Mugabe was sponsored a lot by Gaddafi and by Libya for a while, but it looks like Libya's Gaddafi has lost interest in sponsoring Mugabe. He's obviously thought that this is not such a good investment. So the Libyan connection is phased out and the Red Chinese connection is phased in.
Well, because really what's so interesting is that the American government is doing everything they can to help the Chinese communist government. In fact, recently, within the last couple of months, we guaranteed a $5 billion loan so that the Westinghouse could build five nuclear power plants in communist China. So we guaranteed a loan for communist China. Why would we guarantee a loan for a ruthless communist dictatorship that is actually helping to finance the ruthless dictator in Rhodesia that is oppressing the people there that we promised to protect? There are so many unanswered questions. As you look at what's going on in the world, and most people sort of shrug and say it's just too complicated for me, but the only explanation I can give is that we are supporting evil in China that is exported and metastasizing to Rhodesia and really destroying this once great Christian country.
Well, Dr. Stan, yes, Red China pops up in a lot of surprising places. You'll recall with all of our missionary work in Sudan, where we have been bombed and a mission base has been bombed repeatedly, and many churches have been bombed by the Sudan Air Force. The number one military supplier and supporter of the National Islamic Front government of Sudan is Red China. So Red China provides the weapons that are bombing churches, hospitals, and schools in Sudan, including missionaries. And Red China is also the number one supplier of arms and weapons to communist Zimbabwe. And in Zimbabwe, right now, they are receiving a vast amount of fighter bomber jets, tanks, and other advanced weapons from Red China to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars. And again, where's that money coming from? Here they've got the people starving. The rest of the world must give them free handouts to feed the starving. And as we know, most of the food aid only goes to the Zimbabwean government, army, and their own supporters. But Red China is a common denominator in Sudan, in Zimbabwe, in each of these places that we go where we find the church is being persecuted. It's a strange thing, whether it's a Muslim government, whether it's a Marxist government, Red China is there, and they're supplying the weapons, and they don't do it for free either.
Well, let's get to the Sudan, because, of course, I know you've spent a great deal of time there and gone in many, many times. Now, we understand there are two problems in Sudan. One is with the Christian South. The other was with the Muslim West there at Darfur. Now, what about the Christian South? We understand that there had been a ceasefire, an agreement. The leader of the Christians was to serve as the vice president of the Sudan. And they hoped that they would be able then to solve their economic problems. And after the Christian vice president had returned to his homeland in the south, suddenly his helicopter crashes, and there are really suggestions that maybe this was all arranged. What's the background from your point of view?
Oh, Dr. Stan, that's been a terrible blow to Christians in the south of Sudan who thought that the war was over and peace was at hand. And now the leader dies in a highly suspicious helicopter accident. Of course, it's too early yet to know the details on the helicopter crash. Was it an accident? Was it an arranged accident? Was it a plane assassination? These questions aren't answered yet. But what we do know is this. After 50 years war, and bear in mind, this last August was the 50th anniversary of the beginning of the war in Sudan. So it's the longest war of the 20th century. It started in 1955 in August. The first shots were fired then between the Muslim Arab North and the Christian Black South. Over 2 million people killed in this 50-year conflict of the Muslim North trying to enforce Arabization and Islamization. One language, Arabic, one religion, Islam, on the South. The Christians courageously, against all odds, resisted and succeeded in liberating about 85% of the South. Because although Christians are the minority in the whole country of Sudan, Christians are the majority in the southern region of Sudan, the sort of equatorial rainforest and savanna areas, where Arabs were predominantly in the northern mountainous and Sahara Desert area. So you can see it was really two countries, Muslim Arab North, Christian Black South. And this 50-year civil war came to an end last year, and formally this year they finalized it, and they agreed autonomy for the South, religious freedom for the South, no Arabization, no Islamization. The South can determine its own policy, and all Arab forces would be withdrawn from the South, and SPLA forces withdrawn from the North, not that many were there. They would share the oil revenue half-half. To ensure this, the head of the SPLA, the head of the Christian South, would be made a vice president of the country, which all seemed pretty good, and there was a lot of a feeling of relief and euphoria that at last, after 50 years of suffering and sacrifice and atrocities, the South was being allowed the freedom that, they'd been longing for. But now, 3 weeks after being made vice president, the head of the South, John Grant, dies in this highly suspicious helicopter accident with no survivors. So what are the people in the South to think? The general consensus of the people I've spoken to is that the Arabs had made the peace treaty because they forced to, because of America's present trend in foreign policy and what's happened to Afghanistan and Iraq. But obviously it's not a change of heart, it's a change of tactics. Now, John Garang is well-traveled, he knows numbers of languages, he's a graduate of Iowa State University in the States, he studied at Fort Benning under your military, so he's a well-traveled person, well-versed in international politics as well, and maybe they thought that they couldn't deal with him as easily, or maybe he discovered something that they found he would be hard to negotiate with or manipulate. So the general feeling is he has been removed from the scene by an assassination. That's the talk in the South, and that this just proves that the Arabs do not really mean peace. They are in fact just trying to manipulate the new situation, and that's why they've removed this very experienced leader who led the South for the last 22 years in the war against the Arab North. And so the death of John Garang certainly has put a damper on celebrations of the apparent peace that's returned in Southern Sudan. It's evident that this is more precarious and possibly more ominous than it first appeared.
All right, fine. Well, now, is there peace there? In other words, are the hostilities pretty well quieted down, or do they still continue?
No, the peace is there. We haven't had bombings of churches, hospitals, or schools in the last year or so. There's a general peace, although immediately after the death of John Garang was announced, there were riots in Khartoum, and there were many cases of black southerners reacting with great anger and fury, believing that their leader had been assassinated. Then there were counter-massacres and atrocities by Arabs against black Christians, particularly in Khartoum. That seems to have calmed down at this moment. But there has been no resumption of any actual armed hostilities. There's been no aerial bombardments, no tanks moving. What you had was clashes of some of the supporters of one side and the other, clashing on the streets of Khartoum in the capital city. Aside from that, it looks like there's a fairly stable, although very volatile and suspicious quiet as people wait to see what's going to develop next.
Well, okay, you were free to go in, because before you had to certainly go in, you know, under a great deal of danger. Are you free to get into there as a Christian, or is the United Nations still there doing everything they can to discourage Christian missionaries in the South?
Well, the United Nations has been very much discouraging and interfering with and in fact threatening us even. I've had UN officials say to me, if you take off with Bibles, we'll blow you out of the sky. So there's no doubt the UN's been a major obstacle to our work. But with the peace, the UN no longer had any say over who could access the Nuba Mountains, for example. And we've had no problem flying in the last year in and out of Southern Sudan, including the Nuba Mountains. For the first time, we have free legal access to the Nuba Mountains. All of our work up till now has been done surreptitiously behind enemy lines and no-fly zones, in breach of flight bans, without UN authorizations. But now, in the last several months, we have had an extraordinary amount of freedom and peace to do this. We're enjoying it, but we don't believe it's going to last.
Well, of course, I think it's so important for our listeners to understand that the attitude of the United Nations is violently anti-Christian. I mean, they'll tolerate every other religion in the world, but there's an intense hatred of Christianity, which, of course, confirms our contention that there is truly a conspiracy against the God of the Bible, and it permeates every aspect of life throughout the world, and specifically the United Nations. Now, what about the conflict here in the eastern part of the Sudan? You have the Arab North, you have the black but Christian South. or you should see the Arab Muslim North and the Black Christian South. What about the West? My understanding is there you have blacks, but they are Muslims, and of course the central government is, trying to dislodge them from their government, from their villages, and is responsible for, the slaughter and rape of many of the communities. What's the truth about what's going on in Western Sudan, a place they call Darfur?
Right, Dr. Stan, Darfur is a Muslim area. It's 99.9% Muslim area. It's a black Muslim area with Arab Muslims trying to muscle in on that community. So what you have in Darfur is typical Arab banditry. It's raids, rapes, looting, hostages, atrocities. It's the kind of thing that Arab bandits have been involved in for centuries. It's normal. It's something that's been going on long before the media took attention to it, and I do not believe that the reports we're getting out of Darfur are balanced. That they are generally accurate, but they're not balanced. I think there's been quite a number of exaggerations in terms of numbers, and this is my reasoning. The same newspapers who have steadfastly ignored the decades of anti-Christian persecution with 2 million dead in southern Sudan and the Nuba Mountains, they're the ones who are so concerned about Darfur. And so I have to question the sincerity of this. The same government and the same U.S. State Department that has basically ignored the suffering of the millions of Christians in southern Sudan and the Nuba Mountains are suddenly so concerned about this international crisis where black Muslims are suffering in Darfur. Here's the fact. The conflict in Darfur is Muslim on Muslim. It's black Muslim against Arab Muslim. It's maybe a bit racial, but it's certainly not religious because it's a Muslim on Muslim conflict. And my conclusion on this, Dr. Stan, is, after decades of analyzing the way how the UN operates, is that every few years the UN needs some major humanitarian crisis to justify a further lease of life for their worthless existence of the United Nations organization. And they use these major humanitarian crises in order to motivate the influx of millions more dollars into their bloated bureaucracy to sustain their pretty incompetent, self-serving organization. And so I do not believe that what we are hearing from Darfur, While the reports are generally accurate, I don't believe it's a balanced report. I think they've inflated the numbers. They are certainly ignoring the far greater humanitarian crisis that's been occurring in the Nuba Mountains in southern Sudan because those victims are Christians. And I think that what we are having here is a sideshow to justify further powers and support for the UN, and I don't believe that it's a sort of operation that the average American Christian should be interested in supporting at all.
Well, now let's talk a little bit about what's going on in Zaire and the old Belgian Congo. The figures we've heard are 3 to 3.5 million people have been slaughtered there since this war began. Is that a realistic figure?
It most certainly is, Dr. Stanley. There is no exaggeration there. The Congo, which is one of the largest countries in Africa, has had one of the greatest conflicts going on. And it started, those people who remember back in the 1960s when the Belgians pulled out the Katanga conflict, the Simbas, Patrice Lumumba, and the brutality, the raping of nuns, the slaughters of tens of thousands of people, and the killing of many, many missionaries. Over 260 missionaries got killed in the Congo in the 1960s alone. The Congo has a violent history. It stabilized under Mobutu Sese Seko, who was a kleptomaniac and stole a lot. But in 1997, a whole new phase entered, and from 1997 to the present day, at least 3.5 million people have been killed in the rainforest in the north and in the east. And we've had a tremendous humanitarian crisis there. And I've been astounded at the general lack of interest or focus or coverage in U.S. news reports. CNN, Time Magazine, and others have not given much space or time or attention to the Congo, and that's just another reason why I'm highly skeptical about this Darfur euphoria, where they're all focusing on Darfur as though this is the most important thing going on in the entire world. But far more people have been slaughtered and suffered horrendous atrocities in the Congo. The Congo is a massive crisis, and it's got a Marxist government, Kabila, unelected Maoist dictator, who is the cause of a lot of the suffering there. And yet, for some reason, I don't think it makes any major coverage in your national news.
No, it really doesn't. In fact, it's really so tragic. And so, you know, when we see what's going on and try to get people to be aware of the terrible suffering in Zaire, what about the Christian? Is there much Christian population there? Are they mostly animists?
No, there's a tremendous Christian population in the Congo. There are many animists, but our mission this year has had a couple of missions there, and we've had church conferences of 450 church leaders coming at a single event. There is no doubt God is working in the Congo amidst this situation, and the Christians have really had enough.
All right, fine. We're going to be back in just a moment or two to wrap up this evening's program here. Our guest is Peter Hammond. Peter, let's get your telephone number out. Would you mind doing that?
Certainly. Anyone who wants documentation, perhaps people have said, you know, what you said sounds hard to believe. We'll give you photographs, documentation.
Let's get the telephone number, please.
1-888-918-4100. So it's 1-888-918-4100. Or check our website at frontline.org.za. Frontline.org.za.
All right. Our guest this evening is Peter Hammond, and we're talking about what's going on in the Congo. And really, my understanding that a lot of the problems in the Congo, of course, came when the Hutu renegades who had committed the terrible atrocities in Rwanda had to flee the country to keep from being held responsible for their terrible crimes and for slaughtering the 800,000 or more Tutsis and some of them Hutus, Christians. It was basically a religious war. And many of these renegade military units went off into the Congo. Was that the major thrust of what happened, or were there other factors in the war that's been raging there?
There were other factors, but certainly the Hutu army, the people guilty of the genocide in Rwanda, fleeing from Rwanda into the Congo, that was kind of the first step in the chain of events that led to this a whole ripple effect, this domino effect of other assassinations and mass murders. But yes, you can imagine when you have hundreds of thousands of people who've been guilty of mass murder and genocide in a neighboring country coming and being received as refugees and being given aid by the World Food Program and by UNESCO and all of this, they basically had a chance to reorganize in the UN refugee camps. And then that's when even further terrorism took place. They started to lash out, and the whole chain of events that led to the civil war that actually drew in 12 different nations in Africa. You had troops from Namibia and from Angola going in. You had Zimbabwean troops who are still there. You had other Congolese, Congo Brazzaville, coming in. Next, Uganda and Rwandan forces came in. You had Sudan forces, you had Central African Republic forces, Chad had forces there. So you had 12 different nations involved in this one huge nation in what was almost becoming a continent-wide war. And that's part of a complex situation. But the first step was the Holocaust in Rwanda, and yes, that led to all the others. And, of course, the main cause of the slaughter in the Congo has been the attempts by other communist countries in Africa, like Angola and Zimbabwe, to prop up an unelected, unpopular Marxist dictator in the Congo. This has filled the rainforests with mass graves.
All right, fine. Well, we're going to have Peter back in just a moment here. And, of course, Peter will be with us for those of you who are listening to this program in simply an hour. We'll be playing on the Here's Hope Network, but we'll be playing this, the tape program, tomorrow. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Peter Hammond. And Peter, we're going to have to just do a little business here to tell people a little bit about my ministry. But before we do, I want you to get out your telephone number and your address or email one more time.
Yes, please do visit the Frontline website, www.frontline.org.za. That's also our address, admin@frontline.org.za, ZA for South Africa. Or phone 1-888-918-4100. 1-888-918-4100. That's a phone number, a toll-free number in Arizona, 1-888-918-4100. And you can get books or videotapes or CDs that document this, or ask for the free newsletters and we'll send it. They've got lots of pictures and details on whether it's Rwanda, the Congo, Sudan, Nigeria. These are available. Just ask 1-888-918-4100.
All right, fine. Well, our guest is Peter Hammond, and certainly we support his ministry. We've followed Peter's career over there, and we feel that this is a well worthwhile ministry, and so Barbara, my wife, and I have supported Peter for many years, and we can certainly recommend him to you. Well, this is the time when we have to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and if you're out there in the listening audience and you believe we're involved in a spiritual battle being fought on a political, ideological, cultural, educational, financial battlefield, but everything is really a spiritual battle, we hope that many of you will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters, because that's how we're able to do what we do 5 hours a day. Now, you can listen to our programs 5 hours a day by going to our website at www.radioliberty.com. You can listen live there 3 hours a day, and then, of course, you can link to our other websites, and American Newsnet and GCNLive.com, and listen the other 2 hours a day. Now, you're not going to get much accomplished, but you get a lot of education. And you get a chance, of course, to hear Peter on some of our other programs as well. So, you can certainly listen to our programs live. You can listen to the archives, and many of our programs, this program will be archived, so you can hear it again and get this information. Then we hope that many of you will go and look at my newsletters and pull down the newsletters and copy the newsletters and read the information, check out the facts, find out if these things could really be true. And if you want documentation on anything we say, we'll be glad to provide it for you, because, you see, so much of this information you're not going to be able to get through regular channels. I'd like to mention that we will be having our annual Radio Liberty Conference here in the Monterey Bay area on Saturday, the 19th of November. That's Saturday, the 19th of November. We have some great speakers lined up, and we hope many of you can come. Our telephone number, of course, is 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. If you'd be interested in coming, why, of course, we'd love to see you. And then, of course, we hope that you will help us by telling other people about our program and encouraging them to listen and to get our material and then to begin to disseminate it. And you have our permission to copy anything that we have produced, our tapes, our videos, our newsletters, as long as you're not selling them, why we give you our permission to copy them and disseminate them, because our job is to get the truth out while we can. For truly, we are involved in a spiritual battle for the souls of men and for the survival of Western civilization. So please pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for our leaders and ministers. But please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. And we'll be back here. And till next, may the Lord be with you. Well, James Russell Lowell wrote, "Once to every man and nation comes the moment to decide, in that strife of truth with falsehood for the good or evil side. Then it is the brave man chooses while the coward stands aside until the multitudes make virtue of the faith they have denied. Though the cause of evil prospers, yet his truth alone is strong. Though our portion be the scaffold and upon the throne be wrong, but that scaffold sways the future. And in the dim unknown standeth God within the shadows, keeping watch above his own." Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views. And today we have with us Peter Hammond. And Peter Hammond is with a ministry in Africa called Frontline Ministry, based in South Africa, but with missionaries who go to all of the countries of Africa and even into Eastern Europe, trying to bring the word of the Lord and the hope of salvation to people. And what's really so interesting is we talk to Peter, we find the wonderful effectiveness of the gospel is changing Africa. And, you know, when people are without food, when they're living in constant fear, when they certainly really never feel safe in their homes, it's then that you begin looking elsewhere for hope. And you're not going to find it in Marxism. You're not going to find it in materialism. You're not going to find it in wealth and prosperity. You're going to find it in our Lord. Well, it's always a privilege to have Peter with us, and he's staying in the United States for a few more days, so he's going to be with us again this hour and then be on other programs. Peter Hammond, thank you so very much for being with us again.
Thank you, Dr. Stan. Privileged to be with you again.
Well, we've, of course, have been talking about what's going on in Zaire, and we're, this is the old Belgian Congo. It had been ruled for many years by a dictator named Mobutu, who was a kleptomaniac who stole billions and billions of dollars, but at least there was some stability in the country, and then was his demise and overthrow. Why, now we have a totally chaotic situation. We have a Marxist dictator there who's backed by the Marxist regime in Rhodesia, which incidentally the American State Department brought to power, and by the Marxist regime in Southwest Africa, which incidentally the United States State Department brought to power, and by the Marxist regime in Angola, which incidentally our State Department in Seven Oil brought to power. And then, of course, you have the forces on the other side. You have the forces from Rwanda and from Uganda. Apparently, those are both of those more or less Christian countries.
Well, yes, Uganda is surprisingly Christian these days. In fact, the president makes many references to the Bible and to the Lord Jesus Christ. His wife is certainly a born again believer. So Uganda is amazingly free for the gospel, and after the many decades of persecution church under the Muslim dictator Idi Amin and under the animist and Marxist dictator Obote, it's quite refreshing what's going on in Uganda right now. I wouldn't call it a Christian country, but it certainly is a country where Christianity predominates, and most of the population would name the name of Christ, and there is full freedom for the gospel there.
Now, what's happening in Rwanda today?
Rwanda, of course, is still suffering the effects. They're still deeply scarred by the Holocaust that only ended 11 years ago, let's remember. So the wounds are still very, very sore, and the memories are fresh. But Rwanda does have a government of mostly Tutsi people, who, although they're the ethnic minority who were the victims of this genocide, they have not lashed out in any kind of retaliation. You haven't seen a vengeance or the kind of discrimination or counter massacres that you might have expected. So you've seen some Christian restraint, and I think that reflects the strong evangelical Protestant convictions of the majority of Tutsi. And so this ethnic minority is very cautiously seeking to maintain military control, which, well, is understandable. But they allowed last year the first free elections where everyone could vote. And I think that there's a tentative attempt to move to democracy with a proviso that the Tutsi maintain control of the military, which obviously they want to ensure their survival in the future. That
hold that thought right there. Well, I guess as Peter Hammond were talking about what's going on in Rwanda, and of course the two tribes there, the Hutus and the Tutsis, and the Tutsis are very tall, they're much taller than the Hutus. They're much lighter skinned, and yet of course some Hutus are actually Christians, aren't they?
Yes, some are. Although the majority of the Hutus would have been either Roman Catholic or syncretistic with animism, but animism predominated, and there was a lot of Marxism amongst the Hutu. But yes, there are quite a number of Hutus are Christians, although the minority of them.
In fact, that wonderful movie, Hotel Rwanda, wasn't the hero of that, wasn't he a Hutu?
That is correct. In fact, if any of your listeners have not seen Hotel Rwanda, I would encourage them to do so. Hotel Rwanda is a surprisingly positive film because it doesn't just focus on the Holocaust, which of course would be too depressing. It focuses on the true story of the assistant hotel manager who saved the lives of 1,200 Tutsis in the middle of the genocide by intrigue and by bluff and by good connections and by really tremendous courage. And that is a true story. The thing, though, that is disappointing about the film is the film did not identify the fact that the majority of the people being killed, the majority of the Tutsis who were targeted, were Christians. And so it made it out as though it was just a tribal conflict, whereas, in fact, it was much more than that. It was an anti-Christian genocide.
And, of course, the American State Department put out orders, do not refer to what's going on in Rwanda as genocide, because if we call it genocide, then we'd have to intervene. And we did everything to avoid intervening. There were Canadian troops there. They could have certainly stopped this whole incredible slaughter, this massacre, and they were ordered not to do so by Kofi Annan. Would you like to cover that a little bit? Because I think that is so important. It wasn't that America had to intervene. There were already United Nations forces there.
Well, indeed, yes. That's why I wrote the book Holocaust in Rwanda. I thought it was absolutely vital that people would see the full story of what had gone on in Rwanda. Yes, there were 2,500 United Nations troops there under the command of a Canadian general, and they had armored cars, they had weapons, they were ready. But you know what the film also does not let us know is that the UN troops had actually helped disarm the people that unwittingly made the genocide possible. They had enabled the genocide by disarming the people. So Rwanda was a gun-free zone. The victims had been disarmed. And so the mass murdering government had used the UN forces to help them to disarm the people. And of course,
hold on, stop right there, Peter. We're going to bring our other stations on board right about now. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Peter Hammond, and we're talking about what happened in Rwanda. And, of course, there were 2,500, 2,600 United Nations forces there under the command of a Canadian general. They had armored cars, they had automatic weapons, they were well-trained, they were well-disciplined, and they could have stopped the genocide, only Kofi Annan and the American State Department didn't want that stopped, because this was not a racial conflict between the Tutsis and the Hutus. It was a effort to slaughter the Christians there, and this is what most people have never been told. Now, apparently, what had happened was that the Hutu government, which was in charge, had gotten the United Nations to disarm the people. And just as in the United States, while they're trying to disarm our people under one guise or another, prior to the genocide, which I fear may well come in this country, because if you look throughout the world, whether it be Germany or whether it be Armenia or whether it be Russia or whether it be China or whether it be Rwanda, they always disarm the people before the genocide began. People said it couldn't happen here, but I would point out that the same dark spiritual forces that allowed the genocide in Rwanda and in Armenia and in Germany and in China and in Russia and in so many other countries throughout the world are at work right here in our own country today. So we are involved in a spiritual battle, and unless people understand those spiritual forces, you can't understand what's going on. Well, Peter was telling us about this story. It's a wonderful movie if you have not yet seen it. Hotel Rwanda, we recommend that to you. But Peter, you tell this story because you know the people who were there.
Yes, it was one of the most heartrending experiences of my life, being in Rwanda and documenting what had happened for the book Holocaust in Rwanda. But in fact, they even stayed in that hotel, Millis de Colines, which the whole Hotel Rwanda drama played out in. The role of the United Nations is particularly disturbing, because the UN enabled the genocide by disarming the people, but then worse than that, they did absolutely nothing to defend the people who were looking to them to guarantee their safety. And in the film, they give one misleading scene where the Canadian general is meant to have said, they're not going to come and help you because you're African, you're black. But that's not true. The head of the UN peacekeeping force at that time was a Ghanaian, a black man from Ghana, Kofi Annan. So obviously, it's not that the people are black that prevented the UN from getting involved, because UN forces were in Somalia helping black Muslims at that very time. No, if the film had put in there, it's because you're Christians, you're lower than dirt, you're Christians, that would have been more accurate, because as the people in Rwanda said to me when I was there, the UN are willing to help black Muslims in Somalia, but they're not willing to help black Christians in Rwanda. I never found a Rwandese who was feeling that they were ignored because they were black. They believed, as I do, that they were being ignored and left to their fate because they were Christians. And that's why the U.S. State Department policy under Bill Clinton at that stage was particularly reprehensible. They actually have a scene in a film where you hear on the radio Clinton's representative, press representative, doing this Washington two-step, saying, yes, acts of genocide have taken place in Rwanda, but it's not genocide. And the interviewer trying to work out, how can acts of genocide have taken place, but it not be genocide? And this Clinton spokesman doing all this kind of mental and verbal gymnastics in order to justify the fact that the U.S. at that point was holding up Security Council discussions for weeks on this very issue of arguing over the one word of genocide and not allowing the word genocide to be used. So Clinton's government's nonsense and interference is given a short reference in the film, and I think it should remind people of the fact this was a very preventable atrocity. Something else that the film did not tell us about, but I think should be mentioned, is that the genocide in Rwanda was enabled by the ANC Mandela elections in South Africa, because that's why they timed it for April 1994, because all international attention was focused on the election in South Africa and focused on the Mandela rise to power and all that. And that's why all the journalists and all the international representatives were actually focused in Pretoria in South Africa, and that's what enabled the mass murderers in Rwanda to get away with it, because people were distracted.
Yes, and I'll never forget when, a little off the subject, but when, well, of course, Nelson Mandela was sworn in as president there, and there was, the Clintons, or I think Hillary was there, I've forgotten whether Bill was there, but there was Fidel Castro and Gaddafi and communist leaders from all over the world, because everybody, every communist knows Nelson Mandela was a communist, and yet there's not one in 1,000 Americans know that. A lifelong communist. But, of course, why would the American State Department have brought a communist to power in South Africa? Well, the same reason they brought Mugabe to power in Rhodesia, the same reason that they brought, the Sandinista to power in Nicaragua and Fidel Castro to power in Cuba. People don't remember history because they've never studied it, but in each instance, we did the same thing to those countries. We did to Rhodesia, putting diplomatic pressure on them, doing everything we could to cut off supplies, to undermine the government, to force them to accept a communist dictator. But the American people can't know that. They're supposed to believe that our State Department is anti-communist. But the truth of the matter is, nothing could be further from the truth. Well, anyway, of course, is Rhodesia beginning to recover now? Do they have any industry? Do they have any means, of course, of attracting industry?
There is some means, but it's being, of course, undermined by government policy. If I may just add on to what you said there, Dr. Stan, about Nelson Mandela, I was quite horrified just this last week when I was in a Christian bookshop. I saw a very attractive book on integrity and leadership by John Maxwell, and I, I was about to buy it. I looked at this and I thought, this is great. Integrity, we need it. We need a lot more integrity and leadership for sure. I picked up the book, and as I was flicking through it on my way to the till, I saw a whole chapter on Nelson Mandela. And I stood there in the middle of the shop with my jaw dropping open, no doubt, as I read there an uncritical, euphorically hagiography type writing about Nelson Mandela as the epitome of Christian integrity, and that he earned the right to lead South Africa by his integrity and his courage. And here's a Christian book written as though Nelson Mandela is a Christian, and in it he actually put in there a really deceptive sentence amongst many others, which said in this book that Nelson Mandela had been tempted to compromise his principles by the South African government, who had offered to release him from prison earlier if he would compromise his principles. Well, I think you remember what those principles were.
Well, he was a Marxist terrorist, and he would never forego being a Marxist terrorist.
They said to him for years, you can be released from prison if you will renounce violence, if you'll renounce terrorism, which he wouldn't do. Why would a Christian author leave out that very important fact? So I need to just state a few things in case any listeners are not aware of Nelson Mandela's background. Nelson Mandela, from the time he was released from prison in South Africa, he stood in front of a huge red Soviet flag with a hammer and sickle and with his clenched fist, and the New York Times and the Time magazine published that picture but blanked out the Soviet flag behind it so that the people of America would not see the hammer and sickle that he was standing in front of for all the world to see his politics. I mean, that's censoring the news. But that's not all.
What would you expect from the New York Times?
Well, indeed. But that's not all. Most Americans are not aware of the fact that Nelson Mandela, as president of South Africa, legalized abortion, the killing of babies, legalized prostitution, legalized pornography, legalized gambling. All the vices which were once illegal in the previous South Africa were legalized, including homosexuality, which had previously been a crime. He made it, in fact, the preferred, promoted ethic in the country. Not only that, but we need to remember Nelson Mandela was in jail not for writing poems or opposing apartheid. Many people think Mandela was in jail for opposing apartheid. Well, Bishop Tutu opposed apartheid, but he was never put in jail, nor were many other people put in jail who opposed apartheid. Mandela was in jail for terrorism, for violence, for insurrection, for revolution, and he even pleaded guilty in court to 155 acts of public violence, including planting bombs in public places such as Johannesburg Railway Station, which caused the deaths of many people. When Mandela was tried back in the early 1960s, newspaper editorials as far afield as London and New York praised the English liberal judge who gave him a life sentence for its leniency, because at that time Mandela would have been executed in the United States or in Great Britain under the laws of that time, because of the amount of people had died as a result of his activities as head of the revolutionary armed wing of the ANC. And it's very hypocritical when people today want to say, you know, he was in prison for opposing apartheid, as though you could be locked up for just your political opinions in South Africa as opposed to violent insurrection. And bearing in mind the fact that Amnesty International refused to accept Mandela as a political prisoner, saying he is not a political prisoner, he had a fair trial, and he doesn't meet our criteria of a political prisoner. So bear in mind, Mandela was convicted in a court after all the testimony, and one of the documents that he accepted as genuine was a handwritten document, a 62-page document written by Nelson Mandela in his handwriting, How to Be a Good Communist. And Mandela's defense did not question that that was authentic either. We know where Mandela stands. We can see his support for Castro, for Red China, and all the rest of it. I think Americans need to be aware of who he is, and that he's not the Christian George Washington that many have tried to portray him as.
And I think the great tragedy here in America is how little truth we get from the New York Times and the Washington Post, yes, and the Wall Street Journal and the Reader's Digest, and because, you see, they control the publications on both sides of the political spectrum. You think you're getting the truth out of the National Review, you think you're getting it out of the American Spectator, you think you're getting it out of, well, it's pretty hard to get the real truth about Nelson Mandela or so many other things going on in America today. We'll be right back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Peter Hammond from Frontline Ministries, and Peter is telling us about South Africa and Nelson Mandela. Well, as long as we're on South Africa, what's happening in South Africa? Certainly when I lived there, it was a prosperous country. There certainly was changing race relations that integrated the sports, and then integrated the sports stadiums. They were beginning to integrate the neighborhoods, and they would have overcome the apartheid that was there if it had not been for the tremendous pressure that was put on them, to bring the Marxist power. And, of course, now we have Mabiki down there, who's another Marxist, a close follower of Gorbachev. Mabiki's on the board of directors of the Gorbachev State of the World Forum. If you want to verify that, we have their material. So here's Mabiki, who nobody had ever heard of before, but suddenly he is the president of South Africa. What's happening to this formerly very, very prosperous nation?
Dr. Stan, I'm an optimistic person. I try to look at the positive things, and there are some positive things going on in South Africa. We do have a strong Christian population. We do have a great Christian heritage. We've got a very strong economy, but all of these things are under relentless attack. First of all, our government has tried to paganize a country. You'll remember from when you were in South Africa. South Africa was a very God-fearing, moral population. Pornography was illegal. Homosexuality was a crime. Sundays were revered as the Lord's Day. No shops or cinemas were open on Sundays. The country was very Christian in many ways. There was a Bible reading and prayer, hymn singing at every school, the beginning of each school day. In the army, soldiers were issued with Bibles and enforced with prayer parades, church attendance, chaplain's period, donations to the Bible Society were just automatically deducted from the soldiers' pay as part of their tithes. The country had a lot of amazing, interesting aspects, and it was a peaceful country. It was a law-abiding country in general, and people of all races lived without burglar bars or barbed wire or fear, as unfortunately we live now. South Africa's changed. The ANC has paganized the country. Sabbath desecration, prostitution, pornography, homosexuality, abortion are all legalized. Gambling's legalized. The vices which before would have been unknown in South Africa now are commonplace, and the poverty has actually entrenched. In fact, the economy's got worse under the ANC because of their affirmative action racist policies of job reservation for black people and discriminating against white people on just literally on the basis of color. We don't have a colorblind country. There's none of this Martin Luther King, people will be judged by the content of their character, not the color of their skin business. South Africa is a blatantly racist country now with more than reverse racism. In fact, I would say that the race relations in South Africa today are worse than they've ever been in history. The tensions are horrible, and the race crimes are horrific. We have had 1,700 white farmers murdered since Mandela became president. So in the last 11 years of the country, under Mandela and Mbeki, 1,700 white South African farmers have been murdered. And I don't just mean killed. We mean tortured to death in the most brutal, horrific ways. And that means that white farmers are being killed at a rate 300 times greater than any other section of society. It's a horrific series of atrocities. Bear in mind, there's only 35,000 farmers. We have had 1,700 of them murdered in our country in the last 11 years. So there's no doubt that...
Hold that thought, Peter. Hold that thought. We're going to just bring other stations right on board right now. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Peter was saying that in South Africa there really is tremendous racism. There never was. I mean, when I was there, I never felt any animosity of the black towards the white, certainly not towards me. We lived there, we walked through the black community many, many times, and certainly there at the hospital where I practiced medicine, there was never any animosity that I saw at all. Certainly, there was injustice in the society, there's injustice in all societies, but there was so much goodwill between the black and the white at the time. Well, anyway, apparently that is all changed now that the American State Department has brought the Marxist regime to power. Now, they're not going to let the American people know that. That's not the picture we get, and certainly they've not taken the farmers away, at least not yet. But they have paganized the country. They have certainly given the reverse discrimination so that you don't get permitted or promoted in the government jobs unless you're black, and certainly they're even requiring that blacks be hired to positions that they're not trained for in industry. But then Peter was saying that over 1,700, that's 1,700 white farmers of the 35,000 have been tortured to death and died horrible deaths. And how many of the farmers are just picking up and leaving?
Enormous amounts. Dr. Stan, back in the 1994, when Mandela became president, we had 70,000 white commercial farmers. Today we're down to half that number, 35,000. So obviously many farmers have just left the country. And many of these farms are just completely abandoned. No one else is there, which could, of course, be part of the goal. There have been numerous cases where farmers have successfully protected themselves against assailants, bearing in mind many of the farmers used to be soldiers, perhaps, or in the police. And so many of the farmers are quite capable fighters and have defended themselves against these surprise attacks and ambushes. And on the cases where they've captured, injured, or killed assailants, there have been numerous cases where the assailants were found to be members of the ANC terrorist wing, Umkhonto we sizwe, now integrated into the army or the police. So there have been some pretty senior, captains and majors in the Defense Force who were, of course, ex-terrorists amongst these assailants. So there's a tremendous suspicion amongst much of the population that the farm murders are political, that they're racial, that they are carrying on with the tacit approval, perhaps even the connivance of the government. It's hard to tell exactly, but we can say this much. There has been nothing effectively done in order to stop the farm murders. In fact, worse than that, you may find this hard to believe, but literally the government started disarming the farmers. They've dismantled the commando system. Now, the commandos are like the militia, National Guard, but particularly it's important in the rural areas for the farmers' defense, because for 250 years, the farmers in South Africa have depended on the commando system to protect themselves, not only against external raids or cattle raiders and so on, but and stock theft, but to defend even the border areas of the country. Now, the government has dismantled the commandos, and they're going around to the farms and literally disarming farmers of the weapons that they have. Considering the farmers are facing the most serious threat to their lives ever in history, it seems particularly reprehensible and indefensible to disarm victims of an onslaught when this is war. You will recall the Mau Mau terrorism in Kenya in the 1950s killed 36 farmers. Well, here we talk, and there was a worldwide outcry that the horrors of the Mau Mau terrorist campaign in Kenya in the 50s. Well, now, here we've got, in the last 11 years, 1,700 white farmers murdered and tortured to death in South Africa, and the only response of the government is to seek to disarm the farmers and dismantle the commandos, which were their last line of defense.
Well, I think that really South Africa is in a terrible, terrible straits. Now, what's happening as far as investment are concerned? Are people coming in to invest? I know at one time a lot of industry was pulling out because of the instability and the crime and all. Has that reversed itself, or is there still real problems as far as the industry there and providing jobs for the blacks?
I would say there is tremendous problems. While some people are still investing, the government keeps sending messages that is hostile to investment. We just had the deputy president of South Africa, a woman, say that South Africa should copy Mugabe, that Mugabe gives us a wonderful example, and Mugabe and Zimbabwe's farm program of invading farms and reforming land, we should adopt that in South Africa, and there's lots to support in Zimbabwe. Why would anyone want to invest in a country when the deputy president supports a lawless, racist thug in Zimbabwe who's just been involved in national suicide?
Well, we're going to be back in just a moment with Peter Hammond and What is happening in Africa is a direct result of American foreign policy and State Department policies. And of course, they are the Council on Foreign Relations. The Secretary of State always comes from the same organization. Doesn't matter whether the Democrats or the Republicans are in power, but of course, the American people aren't to know that. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Peter Hammond, and of course, we're talking about really what's going on in South Africa. Well, what about the AIDS epidemic there? We understand that something like 25% of the black population is infected. Is this causing an awful lot of deaths there?
It is, indeed. AIDS is a tremendous catastrophe. You could go to any city in Africa any day of the week and you'll see multiple funerals for AIDS victims alone. There are some extraordinary cases which sound like it's not possible, but where in some communities and townships they will even have multiple funerals of people who are unrelated being done the package deal, where they will literally have 15 or 20 different coffins up front of different families, and each family gets 5 minutes or something to say something, and they have these mass burials. It's bizarre. You have got so many things going on. They're offering cardboard boxes for funerals as coffins, cardboard coffins. There's such a lot of people dying of AIDS in Africa today. The ministries and missions that I'm involved with and know about who are dealing with AIDS orphans are overwhelmed. There are so many AIDS orphans where both mother and father have died. And just take Zimbabwe. Do you know that at independence, life expectancy in Zimbabwe was 59? So in 1980, you had an average life expectancy of 59. Today, 2005, the life expectancy in Zimbabwe is officially 34. So they've gone from 59 to 34 years life expectancy. 34 years is the average life expectancy in Zimbabwe today, and of course a large amount of that is due to government social policies and man-made famine, but also AIDS obviously has a large part to deal with that.
Well now, is the AIDS epidemic influencing the mine production? Is it influencing the stability of industry? Are they able to get lots of workers, or is this having an impact?
No, it's having a tremendous impact. When you think of, for example, South Africa's always had a bit of a socialist medical system where the whites paid for their medicine, but the blacks got it free, and that's been continued. Although bear in mind that in South Africa, the whites are only 10% of the population now, even though we were about a third of the population when I was born, but that's changed. And at this moment, the burden for health care, which is basically providing free medical for most black people in the country, the burden of all AIDS people on the medical infrastructure and the economy is just absolutely insurmountable. Do you know that in South Africa, for taxpayers, we've only got about 900,000 taxpayers? So you've got a country of 45 million people with less than a million paying income tax.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment with Peter Hammond. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and our guest is Peter Hammond from Frontline Ministries in Africa, and Peter always brings us abreast of what's going on. And of course, we're talking about South Africa. I feel very strongly about what's going on there because we lived there for 3 years and practiced medicine at the university hospital, and of course, many of the doctors I trained and helped to train now are certainly as senior physicians over there, practicing in various communities throughout South Africa. Are a lot of the whites picking up and leaving, or are they going to stick it out? How many whites, what percentage of the white population has left South Africa, do you think?
Dr. Stan, I believe that most of the white people are now outside of the country. Some may come back because some are over there for several years on work contracts. You may be interested to know that there's 13,000 white South Africans in Iraq as soldiers, as civilian contractors for the Department of Defense. So that makes South African soldiers, of course they call civilian contractors, but the ex-South African soldiers, that makes South African military contingent in Iraq second only to America. There's more South Africans in Iraq now than there are British troops. Interestingly enough, I'm told officially there are 800,000 South Africans in London alone. The Greater London has 800,000 white South Africans. New Zealand has 400,000 white South Africans, so that makes South Africans 10% of the total population of New Zealand. I don't have the stats on all the other countries. There's obviously many in Canada and in the US and other parts of the world, Australia. At this moment, officially, there are 4.5 million whites in South Africa, but that's not possible. That statistic is surely no longer accurate, because the amount of South Africans who've immigrated to other countries indicates not all South Africans may have registered that they left South Africa permanently, but from the amount of South Africans who've immigrated to other countries, getting those stats, it would appear that more than half our population in other countries. I'm estimating that we've got about 2.5 million white South Africans left in South Africa. You may recall it, at 1994 we had about 5.5 million there, so we're down to about 2.5 million now.
Well, you know, of course, it was an amazing country when I lived there. I mean, you had your black, and then you had your colored, and they differentiated. And in fact, the colored were discriminated against by the black. And then you had your Asians, and you had your Indians, and so you had all of these racial mix there. But they all got along fairly well. They had they were working towards a representative government. They were working towards a colorblind society, as they had in Rhodesia. And the reason they destroyed Rhodesia was not because there was racial discrimination, because there wasn't. There were no racial discrimination laws there at all. And, of course, anybody who had property or an education could vote. But, of course, our government, the U.S. State Department, was determined to bring a communist government to power in Rhodesia and rename it Zimbabwe, which they did. They've done the same thing in South Africa, and I just wonder how much longer they're going to be able to, you know, stabilize the country. I know that, for instance, when I was there, I worked for the university, we got a pension, you know, we paid into the pension fund, but the rands that we paid into those pension funds that at that time were worth well over a dollar. What's the South African rand worth today?
It's about 6.5 rand to the dollar. And, you know, Dr. Stan, I can remember when the South African rand was 2.5 times stronger than the dollar, when you had to pay 2.5 US dollars for one South African rand. Today we pay 6.5 South African rand for one US dollar. So going off the gold standard and the socialist games of our present government have not helped our economy at all. But that's nothing compared to Zimbabwe. When I was brought up in Rhodesia, I remember when the Rhodesian dollar was 3 times stronger than the US dollar, when it took 3 American dollars to buy 1 Rhodesian dollar. Today, you can get it would take you 24,000 Zimbabwe dollars to get 1 US dollar. 24,000 to 1, when it used to be 3 times stronger than the US dollar. So, can you imagine what that does to people's pension funds and savings in the bank? It's absolutely destroyed pensions, savings, earnings. It's an absolute catastrophe. You've got several three-digit inflation on a normal day.
In South Africa or in Rhodesia?
No, I'm talking about Zimbabwe right now.
Right, okay.
South Africa's not as bad at all, but nevertheless, you can imagine moving from a situation where you've got $2 to the rand to the situation where you've got 6.5 rand to the dollar. That represents a 12-fold loss of value. I can put it this way. In 1970, you could buy a motor car for 1,000 rand. In 1980, you could buy a motorbike for 1,000 rand. In 1990, you could buy a bicycle for 1,000 rand. Today, you can buy a pair of running shoes for 1,000 rand.
And this is the incredible thing of what happens when a currency is destroyed, and the people say it couldn't happen here, and I would ask, why not? The same people who brought this tragedy to Rhodesia are the same people in power in Washington, D.C. today. Well, basically, one time we heard a lot about the strategic metals in South Africa, metals that really are necessary for an industrialized society that could not be obtained any other place in the world. What's happening? Are they still producing those in South Africa?
Well, yes. Southern Africa, if you would include even the Congo, Angola, South Africa, and Southwest Africa, what today is Namibia, has most of the strategic minerals in the world. Everything from titanium, manganese, uranium, platinum, through, of course, to the golden diamonds and so on. But without the strategic minerals, of which there are about 14 major ones in Southern Africa, you couldn't make anything from refrigerators to fighter planes or air conditioners. So So South Africa and its immediate neighbors are incredibly important, very strategic to America's military and economy. And so I would think that the U.S. government would have been concerned that these things fall into the hands of Marxists, who are also very friendly, of course, to Muslim radical regimes, such as Saddam Hussein's old regime or Gaddafi's regime, as their ally to them. You would think that the U.S. would be concerned that strategic minerals essential for its economy and defense remained in the hands of a pro-Western government, and yet they worked very hard to put South Africa in the block of those who support communism and radical Islamic regimes. One must ask, why is that?
Well, of course, the people who read our newsletters begin to understand that, that there are other forces in the world that most people are totally unaware of. And, of course, these are spiritual forces as well. But I don't want to get off on the question of why. I'm glad you asked the question, and I would just suggest that our listeners go to our website at RadioLiberty.com and pull down my articles on the occult hierarchy, Part 1 and Part 2. That's the May and June newsletters. And, of course, you can go to Google and Google in occult hierarchy, and don't read my newsletters, which are posted on that website. Read what the people who are part of the occult hierarchy say about their program and their plan, spelled with a capital P. Well, now, as far as South Africa is concerned, why, at least, what's happening as far as the violence? Because, you know, last time we talked, why the incidents of murder there, you know, it risen the incidents of, you know, it was hardly in some respects safe to drive down the streets many times for fear of carjacking. Has that been quieted down? Is there more of a sense of law and order there?
Well, you know, Dr. Stan, it's hard to answer that in one way, because one of the ways that the South African government dealt with the incredible explosion of crime that happened under their watch as soon as they opened the prison doors and let 100,000 prisoners onto the streets and ended the death penalty for murder and really got rid of some of the best policemen they had and started to basically undermine the police handcuffed the police as far as a lot of the work being done. The explosion of crime got so bad that the government then forbade the police to release crime statistics. So how's that for dealing with the phenomenon of crime? You're not allowed to tell people how bad it is anymore.
All right, fine. Well, in other words, the things are not a lot better, because I know last time we talked, well, a lot of the people were living behind barbed wire fences.
Oh, yes, indeed. In fact, the average South African home, and I'm not just talking about my own home, we all live behind burglar bars, security gates, electric fencing, razor wire, crushed glass on the tops of walls, high 6-foot walls, locked security gates, and normal cars now come with alarms, immobilizers, steering locks, and gear locks are normal. So we have all kinds of anti-terrorism, anti-hijacking training. You can have companies in Johannesburg that have pre-rape counseling for the female staff. Can you imagine that you've got a pre-rape counseling in major companies in Johannesburg? I think all this just indicates how bad things can go under a Marxist government.
Well, now what about the Zulus? They were always a stabilizing and very pro-Christian tribe over there in the eastern part, over around Durban and up in Zululand. And what about Chief Buthelezi? Well, what's happening there?
Well, Chief Buthelezi was, in the first two terms, a cabinet minister of home affairs in order to placate the Zulus, but Mbeki dropped him from the cabinet last year, so Dr. Buthelezi no longer has any position in government anymore. The Zulus are pretty much a Christian people, overwhelmingly so. There's a tremendous revival going on in Zululand, based at the Kwasi Sibanto mission station. So God is working amongst the Zulus. Many of the Zulus are dedicated Christians. I'd say the Afrikaners and the Zulus together present the two most Christian people in the area and the best stabilizing force in the country and the best hope for the future in many ways. But the government itself is mostly in the hands of Khoza people and some white atheists. And so between them, I'm afraid this is the battle. Will the Christian majority on the country determine what the future holds, or will it be the atheistic and witchcraft Marxist minority who at this stage hold power? And that's the situation we're in. We've got a group of Marxists and atheists who are pushing a pagan agenda, and the bulk of Christians are frustrated, but unfortunately haven't got the act together to unitedly oppose this effectively yet.
Well, of course, there is tremendous witchcraft and basically the occult influence in South Africa is very, very strong, isn't it?
It is, and we've got to fight this tremendously. As you know, in our mission, we're out on the streets regularly. We have radio programs each week. We are doing seminars and conferences and rallies, and are trying to confront these issues. We even go to Parliament and hold prayer vigils there and do submissions to some parliamentary subcommittees. And we come face up against the fact that many in government and our society are openly, blatantly pushing occultism and Marxism, Satanism even on occasion. And there is an anti-Christian spirit that's in our country. Although it's a minority of the population, it's aggressive, it's militant, and it seems to be protected by a government at this stage.
Well, of course, we know that New Orleans was certainly very deeply involved in the occult. This was a center of voodoo. This was, in fact, it was just last week they were to have the Southern Decadence Convention. That was 150,000 homosexuals were going to descend on New Orleans on Wednesday, but of course the flood came on Monday. And I think whenever a country turns against God, why, there are going to be terrible, terrible implications.
There really are, and I think that we've got to recognize the fact. I was just reading Newsweek magazine today, where someone praising New Orleans, who obviously is on their side, described New Orleans as being the most Roman Catholic town in the country, and having been the city that's got a complete disdain for the Puritan ethos of exercise and denial, and it's a heady mix of French, Spanish, Black and Roman Catholic cultures that separated it from the mostly Protestant Anglo-Saxon rest of the country, and with enormous gay bars and wonderful, lively party spirit there, you're apt to see more naked women in New Orleans than anywhere else in the world. And this is from someone praising it, an inhabitant of New Orleans. And the more I read it, the more I thought, well, now I understand why this tremendous disaster has hit New Orleans. You cannot shake your fist in God's face and promote paganism and debauchery to that extent, and then fling up your hands in horror when you suffer the consequences of this. The fact is, God is sovereign. He does have power over the force of nature, and a people who spit in God's face should not be too surprised when they suffer the consequences. And I think while God is obviously very patient and extremely merciful, any natural disaster, every deadly calamity is a merciful call from a holy God for us to repent. And that's how the Lord Jesus responded to it. When people in Luke 13 asked him about people who died in natural disaster, he said, "Do you think these Galileans were worse sinners than all the others because they suffered this way? I tell you, no. But unless you repent, you too will all perish." And so the Lord showed that every deadly disaster, every deadly calamity is a merciful call from a holy God for us to repent. And I think the people of New Orleans should be asking themselves seriously, what is God saying to them through this?
Well, I hope that the terrible tragedy and certainly in New Orleans and in Mississippi, will be a wake-up call to many people that, as you say, you cannot simply flaunt God and God's laws indefinitely. Whether he allows the things to happen, whether he brings them on, we don't understand the mechanisms of God, but we do accept that his sovereignty in all things. Well, let's quickly, we're almost out of time. I do want you to get out your telephone number and, of course, how people can get in touch with your ministry.
Yes, certainly. We're an African mission, indigenous African mission based in Cape Town. Our website is www.frontline.org.za. That's frontline, F-R-O-N-T-L-I-N-E, frontline.org.za.
That's Z-A, right?
That's Z-A, zebra, right. Alpha for South Africa, or South Africa. You can also phone 1-888-918-4100. That's an Arizona toll-free number. That is 1-888-918-4100. And ask for a free set of our materials, our kit. We've got a whole lot of newsletters, reports on what's going on in Africa. And if you want reports on Rwanda, on Sudan, Zimbabwe, phone 1-888-918-4100 or visit our website, frontline.org.za. Our email address would be similar to that, admin@frontline.org.za. So you just put admin in front of the website address, frontline.org.za. And there's a lot of documentation, photographs, resource materials, CDs, videos, books on these areas, Holocaust, Rwanda, in the killing fields of Mozambique. So if people want documentation of what's actually been happening in Africa, what the UN's role has been, what the US State Department has maybe not been telling you, do check that out. Frontline.org.za.
And of course, I would point out that my wife, Barbara, and I believe in what Peter's doing, and he risks his life regularly. He has a team of missionaries that work with him now, and they have extensions into all the countries of Africa, and God is moving there. This terrible, terrible continent with all the suffering and sadness and violence and wars is seeing a great, great revival. And part of that is certainly the work of Peter and his crew. There are other crews that are doing it, but we support Peter. We hope that many of you will as well. Again, that telephone number, one more time, Peter.
1-888-918-4100.
All right, we'll be right back in just a moment to wrap up today's program. Well, Peter, we've got just 3 minutes for you to wrap up the program. So what's the message you would like to leave with our listeners this evening?
Well, I think the best would probably be informed, be interceding, be involved. And Zimbabwe is the most desperate plight at this precise moment. But there's also the danger that what's in Zimbabwe is going to spill over in South Africa. So contacting the Congress, perhaps speaking up for Zimbabwe and for South Africa, because I think the two are linked in a real sense. If we don't deal with what's going on in Zimbabwe effectively, it'll probably give a free hand to the ANC to do the same in South Africa.
Well, what's going on in Botswana? We've only got just a moment, but they have a fairly stable society there.
They do, amazingly so. Of course, it's a homogeneous society. There's only one tribe, Botswana, effectively. It's a small country, 1.2 million people, basically, one language and so on. But effectively, bear in mind, it's an Anglo-American colony. It's just run by the Anglo-American company. They own the whole place, basically. In a real sense, it's a corporation country, if you know what I mean.
And certainly they have diamond mines, they have copper and zinc mines and things of that sort. So they, of course, have a certain income, so the government has money and it can provide service for the people. Who actually controls the copper and mines there in Rhodesia, or are they in Zambia? Are there copper mines in
the... The copper mines are almost all in Zambia.
All right.
They have been privatized just recently after them being absolutely run to the ground under Kohinda's socialism. But I must say Botswana's been well administered, and I think they make a heavy use of expatriates. That's one of the interesting differences. Botswana welcomes whites to come into the country and depends on the expertise, whereas South Africa and Zimbabwe are basically resenting the whites and trying to chase them out. Botswana's been prospered. Botswana, by the way, just had a 9% growth rate, which made it one of the best growth rates in the world last year, which is quite a surprise. So Botswana's been pretty well run, which you can't say for any of its neighbors.
All right, fine. Well, Peter, it's always such a pleasure to have you with us. And then, of course, you'll be with us again early tomorrow morning. For those of you who want to hear our interview with Peter tomorrow, why it's going to be on the American Freedom Network. Peter Hyland has been our guest, Frontline Ministries, operating out of South Africa, but really operating over this whole continent and even with the extensions in Eastern Europe, spreading the word of God. Good night, Peter, and God bless you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Stan. Good night.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we do hope that many of you have enjoyed the conversation with Peter when he ever comes to the United States. We always enjoy having him on and keeping you abreast of what's happening halfway around the world. Now, this is the time when I need to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty My ministry is listener-supported, and we're primarily dependent upon those of you who listen to our program, who agree that we truly are involved in a spiritual battle that is being fought on a political, ideological, cultural, financial, educational battlefield. And if you'd like to join us in trying to educate the American people about the fact that there really is an occult hierarchy that rules the world, that comes from the other spiritual dimension, and if you have any question about that, we hope that you'll give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. And ask for a copy of my newsletter, The Occult Hierarchy Part 2. And we'll be glad to send that to you free of charge. But if you go to our website at www.radioliberty.com, radioliberty.com, you can pull down that newsletter or many of our other newsletters and really begin to get a grasp of the degree of control that there is over what the American people think, because you'll read things there that you won't be able to find elsewhere. Now, you have our permission to copy any of our newsletters and circulate them, or to copy any of the videos or audio tapes that we have there. You're welcome to copy them and distribute them. We hope that you'll listen to our programs on the Internet. And, of course, you can hear our programs 5 hours a day at www.radioliberty.com, either directly, 2 hours a day directly live. And then, of course, our connections to the American Freedom Network, AmericanNewsNet.com, and the Genesis Network, GCNLive.com. And, of course, if you don't have access to the Internet, why, you can get our shortwave frequencies if you call us at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. We hope that many of you out there will tell others about our radio programs and help us to educate people. This is what I do. I'm a retired orthopedic surgeon. I spend 5 hours a day every weekday, and then we have a weekend program we pre-record, trying to get people to understand the true nature of the enemy we face. And the problem is, most people honestly believe we're involved in a political battle. We're not involved in a political battle. There's very little difference in the policies of the Republicans and the Democrats. We hear a lot of talk about the right and the left, the conservatives and the liberals, but if you read my material, you'll find that they are all basically controlled by the same people, and they put on a great show, sort of like Amos and Andy, or Abbott and Costello, Martin and Lewis, but the truth of the matter is that there is a plan program, there is a master plan, and it is to bring about a one-world government and a new world religion. And there is a conspiracy against God, and you'll find it in the Bible. They write about it in Jeremiah 11:9 or Ezekiel 22:25, or certainly in the second Psalm. So we ask you to pray for America. We ask you to pray for revival. We ask you to pray for our leaders and our ministers, but please pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and for our protection. And so until, tomorrow at the same time, may the Lord be with you.